This episode of The A-Team is brought to you by FaceToFaceGames.com, Canada's number one source for Magic the Gathering card singles.
In 2010, a crack Magic playing unit was sent to prison by the DCI court for crimes they didn't commit. These men promptly escaped from a federal pound-me-in-the-ass prison to the Canadian underground. Today, still wanted by Wizards of the Coast, they survive as podcasters of fortune. If you have a problem, if no one else can help, and if you can find them, maybe you can listen to The A-Team.
KYT.
Anything that costs a shit ton of mana, you're just like, bang! And you're like, fuck.
How does that go?
Bang! Fuck!
Jay Boosh.
And that's like the hyper angle. I never want to play in another GP again. I never want to play in another GP.
Jeremy.
And you're the reason I play Magic today. I'm like, I died. I was like just melting on the inside like that. I have inspired this kid to play Magic.
And Matt.
So I'm having this conversation with this guy in Chile about my deck, and then I'm getting pizza from a guy in Canada. Like, Magic is fucking weird.
And now, the A-Team.
Hey everyone, welcome to episode 285 of the KYT and Jeremy Schofield show. That's fucking
That's
right.
That's not it's what the name is. Jer- the name is Searching for Scotty Mac, right?
It's just me and Jer holding down the fort like we did in late December, I think.
I can't remember.
Yeah, holding down the fort for a bit. But I got us a guest
guest,
someone that's, you know, I'm not sure if we should be fond of him because he's the Doug Potter killer.
That's right.
In Toronto.
Yeah, he did do that
series. So, not sure. You know, I feel too good about having him on the show, but he's a pretty chill dude, and he's been doing really well this year. Jarvis Yu has been doing at one point. Now he's fallen down in the Grand Prix Master race, but at some point he was up there. So, gonna get his thoughts on the standard format. Everything good with you, Jer?
Yeah, things are good. Played in a standard PPTQ this weekend. Didn't do great. Got 10th. So 10th is not top 8. So top 8 is what everyone wants. Everyone wants to win. Yeah, borrowed a deck. Worked out okay-ish. So I don't know. It was a lot of fun.
All right. I actually want to ask you about it after we kick off Jarvis.
Okay. We'll get rid of him real quick.
How's it going, Jarvis? Jarvis?
Oh, just an advance notice to the fans of the show. We don't have the magical pile, power pile. The magical power of Kyle to fix our show, so it may be a pile.
Unless I actually feel the need to fix this, like here.
Yeah, hello? We have a hello.
Oh, or not, he's here. Jarvis.
Hi. What's up?
Hey, welcome to the A-Team podcast. We had introduced you as the Doug Potter killer.
I think you've done some more in Magic, but, you know, that's probably what you'd put on your resume, right?
Yeah, you know it.
Jarv, I want to start quickly. We'll talk about, ask you questions about your recent success and congratulations on hitting gold, was it?
Yeah.
This past weekend?
Yes.
Congratulations
that
on that.
Just this past weekend.
Super ecstatic for you. But I just want to go really back first. Before, like right now, Twitter is booming so much that I feel there's a lot of players anywhere from the grinder all the way to the pro that are on. When I first started Mana Deprived and getting on Twitter, like, it was just very few people, like Mike Flores, etc. You were one of the early ones, and I knew you, frankly, because Jerry was talking about you a lot, or name-dropping you here and there. But where did it all start, Jarvis? Like, when did you get started in Magic?
I think this is probably a pretty common theme among people of our age, but during like elementary and middle school, you know, there were kids with their cards during lunch and saw the cards, and I was really big into reading like fantasy and sci-fi books back then. So was pretty interested in the flavor behind the game, and I think my parents took me to a store and I just, you know, bought some cards, learned some stuff. So that's when I was introduced to Magic as a game, but not as a competitive endeavor, if that makes sense.
Okay. So when did that happen?
So fast forward about, so like that era when I just discovered the cards was probably like 1997, 1998. Fast forward to like 2003, I'm like a sophomore in college. And one of the people I hung out a lot with, his name was Israel Marquez. He was from Roanoke, Virginia, which I don't know if you know, is where the retail center of Star City Games was.
Right.
So he used to work at their card shop after, like, being in school all day. He would just go there and work, like, sorting cards and hang out and, you know, doing stuff. So he had a huge collection during college, and we would just game. And I sort of learned to play competitive Magic by playing Shuhei Nakamura's Rare Deck Wins versus Vampiric Tutor Rock. So I have a very different perspective on, like, I guess I would call it casual competitive. I would just play random, like, decks that are obviously very powerful, but we were just playing them casually.
And then you got more serious into the, like, the PTQ scene?
Yeah, so also during that era, there were a bunch of limited PTQs in the New England area. And I didn't really own any cards, so I just played all of the sealed deck ones. I think the first PTQ I entered, I didn't realize I had to register my basic lands. Which is not really the most obvious thing if you think about it.
Yeah.
Because the judge didn't say anything about it or anything. So I won my first round, got deck checked, and they obviously game lost me because I had no basic lands. Won game two versus Chad Ellis and lost game three, if you recognize that name. He is a guy who used to write for SCG, and his most famous article was The Danger of Doing Cool Things or something like that. And also in the same PTQ, I lost to a young Dan Jordan round three, and then I left. So that was a Kamigawa Block Limited.
Wow. And then you just kept grinding away? Is that how, like, I felt like you were just a name at some point. Your name was, like, constantly mentioned by a lot of, like, known pros.
That, I don't think that happened until, like, 5 or 6 years ago, if I had to guess. Basically, after I graduated college, I played a lot more Magic Online and started to learn things and talk to people. Really, like, I think Facebook and just IRC and, you know, the globalization thing. The world's a lot smaller now. You can talk to people at virtually any time, you know, pick mm-hmm. their brains at almost any time and, you know, just have, like, a really engaging discussion.
So that's how you slowly picked up your name?
There were a bunch of guys on a forum called, formerly known as Mystings. Mystings died because I think Mike Bergoli let the website go, but there were just a bunch of guys who I talked with a bunch on that website, and we migrated to a different website, and I still talk to a bunch of them. Like, some of those people include Bing Luke, Benjamin Peebles Mundy, and a few other people who've had reasonable success on Pro Tours or Magic Online events.
But then did you have some success during the initial run of the SCG circuit?
Yeah. Like maybe like 2008 when they started doing opens. One of the very first opens I think I top aided with Green Black Elves. What set had just come out? I think maybe Shadowmoor had just come out. So I had a bunch of Kitchen Finks and maybe a Primal Command in my sideboard. But that open, I remember I played against fairies like 6 times in a row. I just like beat them every time because my deck was actually good versus fairies, as opposed to most people thought their deck was good versus fairies, but actually wasn't. But yeah,
that trope hasn't been repeated before in Magic.
Yeah, people tend to overestimate their matchup versus a great deck, whereas I just played a lot of matches versus fairies on Magic Online versus people who were probably reasonably good with the deck, and I just kept winning because I knew what you actually had to do, which was get under them and also make sure they don't resolve an Ancestral Vision via a Rift Sweeper post board.
Do you remember this deck, Jer? I think, was it a Japanese design?
No. There are many iterations of the Green Black Elves deck, but Gindi won a Pro Tour with it.
Oh, right. Charles Gindi.
Yeah.
So at that point, that was a point, KYT, where I had stepped out of the game. And it was actually at that point where I started coming back and drafting. So I wasn't paying attention to Constructed Magic at all. I was just learning how to draft and learning how to play again at that point.
All right. I just remember Charles Gindi for that, Green Black, and obviously the DQ over the Master of the Hunt or whatever. That's what.
Yeah, Master of the Wild Hunt.
Oh, yeah, incident. So you were crushing fairies, had some reasonable amount of success, but
yeah.
Would it be fair to say that your last year is basically your most successful year up to this point, or
yeah,
or
I would definitely agree with that. This past year has been the best year so far.
That includes your. I mean, we're still in the same season where we're including your win with lands in Legacy, right?
Yeah, this is the same per point season. So I barely squeaked it out to hit gold. If I didn't do well in Pittsburgh, I was considering paying like the $1,000 or so to go to Montreal.
Oh, damn it!
Yeah, the flights from DC to Montreal, they're basically no directs, and it's not cheap. It's very expensive to go from DC to Montreal when I checked kayak the other day.
So what's the trick with that, KYT? What's the U.S. city that you fly to and then jump in a car?
I would guess Providence or Burlington.
Burlington, yeah.
Yeah, but that's still like a trek, and it's not. I mean, it's definitely cheaper, but I don't think it's that much cheaper, if I had to guess.
Yeah, it's a lot easier to drive down to Burlington, fly wherever, and come back. So, Jarvis, at one point, Jarvis, I think I saw you, maybe I'm mistaken, where you were either at the very top or close to the top of the Grand Prix Master Race.
Technically, I'm up there, but there's no chance I can pass any of those guys. Because I actually did the math. Even if I won every Grand Prix left here, I would still be behind those guys. So,
at one point, were you in the top three, or no, am I misremembering?
Maybe, but if I was, it was probably near the very beginning.
Okay.
By this point, it's just, you know, not worth considering at all. Especially since I want to save, you know, time off to go to all of the Pro Tours for next year as well.
Ooh, must be nice.
Yeah, it is very nice.
Jarvis, is there anything you feel that has changed that, you know, a lot of people that wish to have that, who've never qualified for a PT, sometimes ask, like, people who have had some reasonable amount of success, whether it's just a matter of variance and finally the cards lined up right, or do you actually feel that there was something different in this past year that has allowed you to succeed more than any other year?
So I think it's sort of a two-step process. First, you sort of need to actually play enough games to get your technical skills to be at a point where you can actually win a PTQ or a big event. But this past year, I sort of dialed back the amount of Magic I played, you know, from day to day and spent more time thinking about the game instead. I think that's just healthy because it's not like I need to play, like, hundreds of games in a certain matchup to figure out how it should actually go. I just need to spend more time having a good mental state and also just trying to figure out what other people are going to do instead of grinding games. I think it's just really easy with leagues to just be tempted to just keep hopping into games over and over and over. But the problem with that is you're not actually learning anything there's no discovery going on. I think that's just sort of a pernicious thing to do. If your technical skills aren't up to snuff, then yes, you should jam a bunch of games, but there should be a reason basically for every game you play.
Okay. But at the very start of maybe not a format where a lot of decks are fresh, so you're just jamming a lot of game just to learn all the interactions, and after that you can sort of use that base to basically theorize and play less later on.
Yeah, that's sort of a good way of putting it as well. Especially before a Pro Tour, no one knows what the decks are, so you are forced to play a lot of games to try to discover what the decks are.
Mm. But and I guess you learn from that interactions that might not necessarily be deck specific, but just
right.
Great practice for interactions that you could encounter in different deck styles, right?
Right. So actually before Pro Tour Shadows over Innistrad, I had a Abzan Company Brood Monitor Displacer Cutthroat deck. It wasn't quite there. But then other people on my team sort of figured out how to make it work with the four color rights version of the deck.
Hmm.
But like my deck had like Beast Color Savant in it and stuff that is not very good, but it's hard to know what's good and what's bad without trying to discover those exact specific questions. It is what I'm trying to say.
One side question, Jarvis, do you watch a lot of? I've asked this to Hain, and he said that at some point that he watched a lot of past PT coverage and games to try to learn from them. Was that ever part of your process?
Yeah, especially nowadays, I basically watch all of the video coverage I can just to discover things. It's really nice when you can see all of the players' hands, and it's sort of, you can figure out the narrative that's being told in every game based on, you can tell how each player expects the game to go as well when you watch those games, especially in old Pro Tours at the highest level of competition.
Hmm. So you're not necessarily following like what a commentator is necessarily saying. You sometimes just try to visualize how the game will play out by yourself.
Right. And actually often I just mute them. No, I'm serious, because the thing is, it just introduces outside bias to your thought process.
Sweet.
I like that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Jared, I don't know, for guys like me and you who don't have that much time anymore, we still have to grind those games, right?
Yeah, we definitely have to grind those games. That's trying to find the time to grind those games. Like, that's why Magic Online really steps in. Jarvis, are you a big Modo player?
So back to that question about what has changed in the last year. I used to play a ton of Magic Online. In my earlier days, I would play all of the fun formats, if you remember. Cool. I would play 100 Card Singleton, Tribal Wars, like Prismatic, basically Momir Basic, all of those.
Momir Dailies, man. Momir Dailies. Yeah.
I played all of the fun format daily events because I just wanted to get more tickets. And the thing about those events is there's not really a known metagame in most of the time, so you're forced to innovate and explore things by yourself. I think this is one of the things that sort of set me apart from a lot of the other people who maybe like they sort of came up through the ranks of, you know, playing with people who are already established pros. So they approach the things from that, you know, sort of, oh, I need to figure out how to do this thing for this upcoming Grand Prix or whatever. And sometimes it might be more difficult for them to figure out how to do things on the fly.
Yeah. Well, that's where you see like the team dynamic is usually you'll have people who are good at one specific aspect of, you know, playing Magic, but not playing the Magic. Like for deck, you'll have deck designers. You'll have people who can, you know, critique decks very well. They understand card power. You have people who can tweak a deck to kind of step up. You have people who understand metagames and are able to predict the metagame really strong. Like, and all these guys get together and they're able to kind of churn through lists and find the right list and then tone that list into something that's really able to attack whatever they perceive the metagame to be. And you don't find that one set skill set in a lot of people. Like, to be able to do all of those things, because at that level, you have that team environment that you can count on certain people to bring certain things to the table.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. Like, I've asked Alex for, like, how he selects certain players and if certain players apply to his team that have the same skill set as other players that they already have, their chances of making it on the team face-to-face is not really high. I don't know what the conditions of leagues these days are, Jared, because I think someone tweeted, maybe PV or Kibler, I don't know who, about, like, being, like, I saw it on Twitter, being in a standard queue for a long time.
So. I find that I have to wait about 4 to 5 minutes to get a game whenever I go to play a league.
So I think the first iteration of leagues had really loose requirements for record pairing. And they tightened up those requirements quite a bit, so that's why the wait time is longer.
Oh, did they? Okay.
Yeah. That would be my guess, because you can't really have it both ways. You can't be paired instantaneously versus the same record unless if there's a lot of players in that league.
Yeah.
Right.
See, it's where it's like the times that I have noticed where my opponents are at, or you get like the salt from your opponent where it's like, wow, you didn't deserve to go XO and you're on like game two. And you find out that you just beat like a guy who was 4-0 or something like that, where you, like those types of things. I've seen that happen. I you know, rarely look to see if they're actually tightening it up, but it's one of those fun things, you know, when they were joking about that GP that got all messed up and they had to random pair the whole thing. I remember seeing a Twitter comment just saying like, oh, it's just like an online league now where it's just random pairings. I was going to say.
Fucking guys.
That event didn't actually get too messed up. I was there. Only two rounds were completely randomly paired, which, I mean, that's still kind of bad. But considering that the software just ate some data file or something, that's relatively good speaking. It was not Star City Games' fault. It was the Wizard software's fault.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, I understand that completely. Just, you know, it was a GP that kind of went a little haywire, and I hope they learned something from it. So
definitely went haywire.
Yeah, watching the videos, because I was at a 1.5K tournament local here, and I remember all of us just looking at our phones and watching the tweets and watching the comments coming out, and the people doing little Vine videos of the lineups to get the passes.
Oh, yeah.
It was just obscene. But no, going back to the league thing, it's tough. That long seems like it's not where they want to be at, but it's also something that they just kind of have to accept, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't know what they can do to change it to make it a little bit better. At least with Constructed, it's not as painful as waiting for a draft queue to fire. Because when you're waiting for a draft queue to fire, if you alt-tab, then you missed your first. Jarvis, I played like probably about 75 Magic Origins drafts. Mm-hmm. I would say that I made my pack one, pick one in about 30 to 40 of them. Like I would quite literally join a queue, alt-tab, not get the pop-up saying that my draft is fired, and I would get in anywhere from like pick five to pick five and pack two, you know, I'd just be all over the place.
Yeah.
Ouch.
Yeah. So
that's not great.
No, that's not great. So I got no problem with the leagues because it's like, I go into it. It's like, oh, okay, well I'm behind a couple minutes on the clock. No big deal.
Jarvis, do you have an opinion on whether the pairings should be tight or loose?
I would prefer them to be tighter. But I understand why they've loosened it up, because people really hate waiting.
Mm-hmm, right. I mean, I agree with that. I think that's like for guys like me and Jer, at least I'm assuming, Jer, that you agree with me. Like for guys like me that just want to get a lot of games in, I don't think, because for me, I'm just trying to learn the mechanics of even my own deck, right? It's not just like a specific matchup that I really care about when I'm just warming up and need to learn, like, let's say, Bant Humans for the first time or Four Color Rites. I just want to go through some of the motions as quickly as possible. So
There's an aspect to that, but at the same time, leagues still suffer from the fact that you get decks in there that... Well, it's Magic Online, so the decks that you play on Magic Online don't necessarily represent what the metagame is. Right. I was testing that... what is your buddy's name? David Schneier or whatever?
Yeah.
Is that how I say his name? Oh,
yeah, yeah.
Okay, so I was testing his deck online, his Esper thing there. And I played in one league where I played the exact same deck four times out of the five matches.
What was the deck?
The deck was the red-blue counterburn thing with the flash creatures.
Oh, shit.
Like, not an actual deck.
Right.
It's a deck, but it's like it's a deck online that's very popular because it costs probably about 8.5 tickets to put together. Like
right.
It's got nothing expensive in it. So, for instance, I played against that deck. I played four leagues to test for my PPTQ that was coming up. I ended up playing a completely different deck, obviously.
Right.
in that, I probably played against that deck. I think I played against it 8 or 9 times. So out of the 20 possible games I played against it, somewhere in the range of 40-45% of it. Never saw it once at the tournament I was at.
No, obviously.
Because it's an online deck. So there's little things like that where I don't know how well that deck normally does, if that deck is a strong deck that can put up wins. But if the matches are a little bit tighter and I'm winning a few matches, then maybe I don't play against that deck and I play against something like, I don't know, maybe Green-White Tokens. I've heard that's a deck that people play. You know, things like that. So that's where online can kind of get you, is that the decks on there aren't necessarily the best decks. It's more Magic Online really amplifies the whole aspect that Magic the Gathering is a pay-to-win game. And
right,
people, when they're playing games online, don't necessarily want to do that.
I think that might be more true in a league as opposed to the like a PTQ finals online.
I would agree with you completely, 100%.
Like,
I think the quality of player is going to be different, and those people are going to either have the resources or are going to have the community, friends, whatever the case may be, to have the resources to have a better deck, you know, for that. So like I've got a buddy who doesn't play, and he's going to borrow cards off of me for his online PTQ because that's what you do. You play the best deck possible.
So I kind of don't think, especially in the way they design standard decks nowadays, that there's necessarily one best deck anymore. There might be one deck.
There's still a tier. There's still tiers.
Sure. I would agree with that, but I think the term best deck is sort of misleading.
It is.
There are a bunch of decks that are reasonably power level, and any of them can win a tournament, and their matchups versus each other tend to be relatively even.
Absolutely. Like, if someone were to ask what is the best deck in Standard right now, there isn't a single answer. There's a lot of places that you can go. My argument is that on Magic Online, though, you can play against a deck that would not be in that conversation because of the price of the deck.
Right, and this is kind of why I don't like to use leagues as serious testing.
Yeah, it's not great for that. And that's where if it was a little bit tighter, maybe you get a chance to play against more of those decks after maybe the third round or whatever the case may be. The tough part is that I'm somewhat limited to leagues because I got the kid, I got the wife, I got a lot of hours. I have to be at work. I don't get a lot of time to do things. I get about an hour a day to do anything that I want to consider relaxation time. So if I want to play Magic, I'm either playing a two-man, which is might as well be in the tournament practice room, or I can play a league, which is somewhat competitive and hope that I find more than just the two-man competition. I don't have time for doing an eight-man. Or if I am doing an eight-man, it's just like play the match and then concede at the end because I don't have the time to play through the rest of the rounds.
Right.
So that's where I understand that with more time, with more availability, with more Magic time, I can have more, I can improve the quality of my testing, but with what I'm limited to, I have to kind of make the best of it. So,
Jarvis, if leagues aren't your preferred avenue for serious testing, what are they? What are the things that you look for?
So I typically try to arrange games versus people I know who are at a certain level of competence. And as I said, I try to playtest with some sort of idea of what I want to learn in mind.
Okay.
So I try to sort of make it have a purpose, essentially. The purpose could be something as simple as, like, what happens in a post-board game of this matchup? Right. So I'll only play post-board games of that matchup online because I'll just make a second deck file of the post-board configuration.
Neat. So how much prepped, what did you play for GP Pittsburgh?
So that tournament I didn't actually prepare that much for, but I played a deck that I played in Toronto and New York, which was the green-black Cryptolith Rite Husk deck.
Okay. Ooh.
So the reason I put it down to begin with by GP Minneapolis was there was a lot of Kalidus Languish control decks. And then if you track the trend very closely, by the time this tournament rolled around, green-white was everywhere and had driven out basically the Kalidus Languish decks.
So now you thought it was time for the right stack to pray again.
Yeah. What I sort of didn't account for was the green-white decks have actually adapted to be much better versus the right stacks as well. So my post-board configuration wasn't as good as I wanted it to be versus them, but it was still like within an acceptable boundary, I would say. It just wasn't as dominating as it used to be for rights.
Hmm. What adjustments have they made on their side?
They have a lot more sweepers in their sideboard, and they basically cut all of the bad creatures from their deck in the matchup. They used to have like Thraven Inspectors and things that they would Evo Leap into, but nowadays they basically only Evo Leap into Dead Protectors, Hangerbacks, or Avacyns.
Yeah.
Like the fact that Inspector was in their deck was meant that they could hit it off Evolutionary Leap.
Is Hangerback good against you?
It's good because it triggers Avacyn.
Ah, right.
It's not actually good as a creature. But yeah, that's basically their deck is much better versus Rites now than it used to be. Even though I think probably the Rites deck is still favored, it's not dominating anymore.
So you don't feel it's necessarily, like, if you were to play this again or a standard tournament coming up, would you still play that deck?
I would investigate what I actually want to do post sideboard and make sure that plan actually works.
That sounds good to me. Were there any interesting interactions or matches that you had during the tournament?
Trying to think. Oh, there was a game where I was playing against, like, sort of mono-red splash white Eldrazi where we both flipped Westvale. He started attacking me, and he shouldn't have. Like, basically, he was ahead on flyers, so if he doesn't attack me, I have to just leave my Ormondal back. I'm at 11. He has 3 Thopters. He could have just drawn running Pian Cairns to kill me because I can't ever attack him. Because basically what happens is if I attack, he just attacks back and deals me like 5 damage extra.
Yeah.
So, but the fact that he kept attacking me and I kept blocking meant my life total got to like 70 and his was at like 80, 88 or so. And just drained him for like 96 damage in one turn. Because what basically happened was it gave me enough of a life buffer to use Duskwatch Recruiter plus Rites to basically go through my entire deck.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that just gets out of control very quickly. And I don't think I do not believe he realized that the game was going to play out that way, even though I instantly saw that this was going to happen if he started attacking me. I think he just didn't realize who had the better late game, and it was me by a large portion.
And did your seed into getting gold, was it the last match? Did it come down to that, or was it before?
Fortunately, wow. I got paired versus Jerry. And
oh, wow, out of all people!
Yeah, he did not need the points, so he
generously... Oh, he gave you the old scoop?
Yeah, he generously conceded to me.
Well, that's awesome.
Yep. Yes, it was basically an ideal situation for me, I would say.
I'm glad. I'm really happy for you.
Yep.
To be qualified for, you know, the next year. I'm seeing in this top eight list a bunch of Bat Humans deck. I don't know if you have that much experience playing against it.
Yeah, it's a high variance matchup. I would say Wrights is marginally favored, but it's definitely close.
Because I remember talking on this show that I had tested Yuya's initial incarnation of it and was not impressed by it. Felt like in a lot of matchups that I, you know, really, it was high, the deck was high variance. Like when I drew Thalia's Lieutenant in some key moments, I was just blowing my opponent out of the water. But now I'm just like quickly comparing the lists, and it looks like they shrunk the number of Knight of the White Orchids in favor of just adding Eldrazi Displacers.
Yep.
Which I could see making it some significant difference, because like Knight wasn't that, you know, outside of it being a human, the fact that there's a lot of I really needed like Thalia's Lieutenant, because there's just so many 2/3s in the format that it was just a 2/2 first strike that was just sitting there a lot of the time for me.
Yeah, so Adam Ragsdale is actually from Toronto. I don't know if you know that.
No, I do not. No,
he's a friend of mine back, also way back in the Magic Online days that I was referring to. He really did not play that much real life Magic until somewhat recently. Do you know Duncan McGregor, actually?
He's a familiar name.
He's a judge from Toronto, and I believe Adam just borrowed the entire deck from him. Because Adam, as I said, Adam basically only plays Magic Online. Adam did realize that his testing online was not the best, but he's like, this deck at least seems reasonable. I'm just like, the thing it does seems like it punches a lot of people to death. Which, that's exactly what the deck does. It's just, he described it as a humans deck that never runs out of gas. Which I definitely believe.
Yeah.
Like, there's three Tireless Trackers and two Duskwatch Recruiters and three Eldrazi Displacer. That means, even if you're mana flooded, you'll just have something to use your mana on. Like, you just crack a bunch of clues, or you just, like, displacer all of their guys so they can't attack you, or you recruit a few times. I don't know. Like, this, it's a humans deck that just never runs out of gas.
Might consider it. Even Pascal did really well, finishing in second. And then there's actually three in the top eight.
Yeah, Pascal didn't play the fourth Inspector, which is sort of confusing to me. And he also had one random Knight of the White Orchid, which I also don't really understand.
Yeah, what I just said that I was extremely unhappy with. I think I would cut them all, just based on my personal experience.
Yeah, basically, the deck has enough mana sinks that I don't think you need a third recruiter, and I think the fourth Inspector is good for curve reasons. But yeah, in any case, I think most of the decks in that top eight are reasonable. Didn't really like the Soul Tie list that top eighted, but apparently that guy had an epic journey to get there too. He's from Serbia.
Wow.
So he apparently flew to New York, then took whatever number hour bus ride from New York to Pittsburgh.
What?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah. That's what the coverage said, and I'm just like, it's pretty impressive. Apparently, he got the list from Brad Nelson.
All right. Super constructed grinder, Brad Nelson.
Yeah.
But, like, Green-White Tokens ended up winning again.
Yep.
And still looks really good. It took down Jacob Wilson took down the first WMCQ over here.
Yeah, I saw that.
With Green-White Tokens, and he felt after the tournament, and he didn't, The cover, it was confusing. I'm not sure if he didn't drop a match, but maybe he didn't even drop a game. Oh, no, he did drop some games, at least one that I saw. So he didn't drop a match, and felt it was by far and away the best deck. I don't know how you feel about that. Like,
I think the deck is really good, but I also think it has some exploitable holes. The exploitable hole in that deck is that it's kind of clunky. So if you get under it sometimes, that it can have an issue. That's sort of why the green black whites deck used to be good versus it. It would just get under it and then be able to leverage a mana advantage off Cryptolith Rite to really punish the green white deck.
Right.
As I said, I don't think that's as true nowadays, but I've had generally a positive record in the matchup. Although not dominating anymore, just positive.
Yeah, I see some people. Like, I saw how Jacob had basically cut Tragic Arrogance for like 3 Planar Outbursts in the sideboard.
Yeah, Jerry invented that, I think.
Right. Yeah. I think they said they got it from Jerry.
Yeah.
But here in the top 8, I'm seeing them like still playing. Like, some of them are playing Tragic Arrogance main with some amount of Planar Outburst in the sideboard. So that's interesting. They're playing 2... Like, Steve Rubin had 2 main as well. Well, that's interesting.
Yeah, I kind of think the cards are similar enough that it sort of doesn't matter which one you play.
Mm-hmm.
The advantage of Planar Outburst is that it wipes all the creatures off the board so Gideon can kill it in opposing Planeswalker.
Right.
That's the major advantage in my book.
Alrighty. Enough about this tournament, Jarvis. I heard you in your... Not heard. I read on your Facebook post that you have joined a team. Is this the first time you're joining this team, or had you been working with them previously?
No. When the team was invented, I was first on it as well. It's just I wasn't qualified for Sydney, so I was not going to be like directly in the talk for that Pro Tour, but I mean, I guess now I am. It is what it is, you know?
You were part of that crew that put the Eldrazi deck, that won the PT with the Eldrazi deck?
Yeah. I actually chose not to play that, but that's because I think my deck was also very good versus Eldrazi, which was Abzan Malera Company.
Okay.
I think that was like basically the only deck that had a reasonable win percentage versus Eldrazi and versus other decks.
Is there anything that you could take away from that experience or your previous experience that you plan to maybe do things differently or improve on for this upcoming PT?
Yeah, I think we're trying to figure out a better way to discuss Limited. It's sort of difficult because people basically have like a predisposition to draft like a beatdown or a control deck, like just because of natural predisposition. That's sometimes hard to tell what you should actually do in any particular draft. And even that, it might vary wildly between 2 different people.
Right.
It's sort of hard to, I think, to come up with a great way of analyzing Limited, I think. But we're still working on that. I think all of the teams basically are working on that all the time.
Yeah, and then there's the... there's always... I know some teams like only like to come together if they can have compatible travel schedules. Like some people like to work at the same time, be there at the same time. And I'm assuming Pascal's back on this team as well?
Yeah, I think so. I haven't heard differently myself.
That's the East-West, right?
Yeah. So
yeah.
Going back to that point about compatible travel schedules or whatever, it is worth noting that a large portion of the team lives in California and the large portion of the team is centered around Maryland and DC. So what actually tends to happen for Limited especially is that there will be 2 separate like draft camps, I guess is the right word. And it's sort of nice because you can get two separate sources of data and not have them influence each other.
Mm-hmm.
And just try to see what is doing well or what makes sense.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it's nice because when you have everybody in there, you might get a few ideas. You might get somebody who overpowers everybody with an idea, and you start to get some really inbred testing. Right. So it's nice to get results that are outside of that sphere of influence and kind of impact what you're doing. And they just have to be coming from people that you trust, and you have to be able to trust your teammates in that sense.
Right. Exactly.
Well, Jarvis, thank you for your time. Would you like to plug any of your social media accounts?
I mean, I guess if you want to get in touch with me or ask me a question, it's most likely that you should do it on Twitter. My handle is JKYU06.
Sick. And yeah, thank you so much for coming on. I thought it was really insightful to learn how, you know, things that you've done to get that success that you've reached, that a lot of players strive for, even. That was really good to me to even hear, to know that what I should be doing, to really know that what I can do with the limited time I have to make sure I can compete and win a tournament. So thank you so much, Jarvis, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yep, talk to you soon.
It was good to have you, Jarvis.
Yep, have a good night.
What a polite manager.
Yes, far too polite for this show.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So what did you play? What did you end up playing in your tournament?
So I tested with your buddy's deck. And okay. I don't know how to play it.
Fair.
Like, that's the thing. I'm not going to say the deck is bad, because obviously the deck's put up results. But I don't know how to play it. Or it was also impacted by the fact that blue-red deck, I don't feel like that's a very strong matchup for that deck. They have too much reach. They have too much burn. Like, you can stall the game out, but then they just go up top. And the fact that they're doing all of their stuff at instant speed just makes it really hard to interact with them. So I had two decks that I wanted to play. I wanted to try out your buddy's deck, and then the other deck I wanted to play was the Planeswalker deck that I was talking about that my buddy Mike Lewis was piloting and had been top 80 in a lot of events and finally was able to close and steal and win a PPTQ. So I called him up, I asked for his list, and I borrowed it. This is the deck that was like the Oath deck that had like Oath of Chandra and Oath of Nyssa and Oath of Gideon and all that kind of stuff. He got rid of a bunch of the cute stuff. He got rid of the Oath of Chandras, he got rid of the Oath of Gideons, and he just replaced it with just solid cards. He put some Avacyns in. So it was just the Naya Planeswalker control deck.
Okay.
In a kind of a nutshell, it ran Sylvan Advocates, Chandra, Gideon, Aran Kord, both Nyssas, like the Nyssa Flipwalker and the Nyssa 3-drop. So you're just kind of dropping out a bunch of tokens. You got a couple Secure the Waste if you need to kind of do some crazy stuff. So like, I had games where it's like, drop out a few guys, drop out a Gideon token, build up a Gideon attack, be making plant tokens, Aran Kord, make a wolf token, then Aran Kord plus one everybody, do a emblem with a Gideon, and plus one counter all my guys and attack for infinite. You know, it had the ability to do that kind of stuff. So the deck played out well. My first round was against Dean McLaren. So everyone who knows Sean McLaren, Dean McLaren is his brother, who also plays Magic, who's also very good. Hasn't been able to kind of get past the whole PPTQ scene, but he's also a guy that you're going to run into at these tournaments, and he's always going to be a heavy threat. So I played against him first round. He was playing a... What deck was he on? He was on like the black-green control deck. So lots of removal and then the ability to just kind of beat you up slowly in the later parts of the game. which is exactly what he did, is he just was able to planeswalker me, get some advantage. Or no, so he wasn't playing green-black, he was playing white-black. He was playing the white-black control deck.
So the Seth Manfield deck.
Yeah, so just being able to beat up on you and then get a Gideon out and just make tokens and kick your butt that way.
Yeah.
So it was a tough game because, like, our game one, we play it out. I get him to one. I got him stuck on one forever, and then he starts to bash him with the man land and is able to kind of steal the game away from me. I have an Alpha Strike that I just can't close the game out with. And one of my regrets in that spot there is that I probably shouldn't have gone for it. The way that he had been playing, it didn't seem like he had any removal. But he was actually sitting on a removal. And the turn before, I play Gideon. I go to zero with Gideon. And then I'm like, zero with Gideon, make a token. He's like, yeah, yeah. Or he doesn't really say anything. And then I'm like, and pass the turn. And then he sits there and he goes, cast a Hallowed Moonlight. I'm like, oh, geez, was that in response to my token? Because, like, yeah, he didn't really say anything. And he's like, oh, no, it wasn't. You know, so it's like, oh, well, he just missed it. And now he's just cycling it for a card. And the way that he said it made me really feel like, you know, he was like, yeah, I missed that. I shouldn't get it. No, you get to keep your token. When in reality, he was baiting me. Because the next turn, he sits there. The next turn, I have all this stuff put together, and I have just enough to do a lethal attack. So I kind of go all in to make that lethal attack. He has a removal spell, and then he's able to play a couple more spells on his turn to clear up the board enough for him to go in and kill off my planeswalkers and just wipe me out. And then all of a sudden, I'm sitting on nothing. He's got his Gideon going, so I can't punch through. I've got a couple live draws that actually just finished the game for me, but just can't get there. So that was a tough one. That game.
You're convinced he baited you.
Oh, when we were done, when the match was done, he sat there and said that was what his plan was, that he actually had baited me. Like we talked about what happened. Because he was sitting there saying that if I hadn't made the all-out attack and if I had just kept building pressure, I probably would have had a really good chance to actually beat him. Like he thought that me making that attack was probably the way that I lose that match. Or lose that game, and why he had done the thing the way he did is because he saw that he was leaving that attack open. So,
oh wow,
he played me like a
wow.
He played me like a fiddle.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Wow, what a boss. Okay.
And that's the thing is that he's not one of those guys that takes credit for things that just happen. Like he's a really down to earth sort of fellow. So, I'm pretty sure that. He played me. He played me well. So that was a rough one. Game one took almost all of our time. So game two, even if I had won game two, we probably would have went to a draw. Like we were almost out of that time. I think we had like 13 minutes left after game one because the game just went forever. So that was rough. Match two, I end up playing against another black-white control deck. This time I run all over it. Opponent just doesn't have the draws, isn't able to kind of put the thing together. Gets just bad draws. Some odd plays that don't really feel right. I don't have the specifics, but you know, just when you're playing against somebody and you see them doing things, you're just like, I don't think you're understanding what the important cards are in this matchup or understanding what you need to be focusing on or what you should be attacking on my side. To shut me down. It just really felt like they were kind of didn't really understand what was happening in the game. And nothing wrong with that. Just I think I had an advantage just because I had been playing kind of a long drawn out game against the deck previously. And the deck I was playing is not really a known quantity. So we end up playing that. My next match I play against I'm at 1-1 at this point here. I play against... Oh my goodness, I can't remember who I play against at that point, but I played against a white-blue counterspell deck, so very much like the red-blue deck, just it's playing some different stuff, but it's still kind of based around that whole concept of lots of counter magic and flash creatures. And then it also had the flash O-ring or whatever. So you kind of try and build up your stuff, and you're just running into counter spells left, right, and center. End up losing to that in the fourth round. Play for the X2 game against another judge fella, and he was playing the collected company deck, like the Bant collected company deck, and he just makes some bad plays. I make a terrible play. I have the judge comes up to me and says, yeah, you guys need to stop right now. Just hold up a second. And then another player is pointing out. And on my turn in game one, I had a flip Nissa and I had the other Nissa out. So I flip my flip Nissa. I draw a card or do the reveal card, end up putting it in my hand. Then I do a Nahiri loot. So do that. And then I have my other Nissa, my three drop Nissa, that I crack and draw seven cards with. And that's when the judge steps in. So he's like, wow, this is really messed up. We got to try and fix this somehow. And I'm like, I don't know. And it's funny because it's myself and the player I'm playing against are two judges also. So there's the three judges here all staring at this situation like, how do you fix this? And he's like, I'm just going to deviate like hell. And he sat there and came up with like a plan where essentially he was just keep one of your planeswalkers, the one that you get rid of, we're going to rewind that effect. So it's like, well, geez, I can rewind the look at the top card from my flip walker, or I can rewind drawing seven cards. Which one am I going to do? So got rid of the flip walker, put the card that I had revealed into my library, shuffled it up, and we went on with that. And I got myself a little penalty for that because that's what you get warnings for. But it was just like the two of us were right at the end of the day. We're just done. I didn't think I had a chance at top eight at that point because I had X2 at the end of round four. So I should have been completely out at that point. But, you know, it was just kind of out at that point. So I was just playing to see, you know, maybe I get some weird sort of tiebreakers. I ended up landing in 10th. So it was a decent turnout. I didn't have any practice with the deck. I didn't really have much of that. So I'm kind of happy that I put up a positive record, but obviously want to get the top eight. Yeah, one thing I did get to play a crap ton of, though, was we played a lot of Judge's Tower.
Okay.
Yeah, did I tell you about this stuff? I think I talked about it on the show before.
Maybe, but my memory escapes me on what it is.
Okay, so Judge's Tower is a game that also goes by the name As Soon As, is another name for the game. It's a Magic variant, and you play with a deck of cards, and when the game starts, everybody starts with zero cards in their hand, or more accurately, they start with a number of cards equal to their judge level in their hand. So if you're level one judge, you start with one card in your hand. Then you play. Yeah, but trust me, having cards is a bad thing in this.
Okay.
So you play it like however it is. So if it's a multiplayer, you draw on your first turn. If it's not multiplayer, then you don't draw, you whatever the case may be. And the whole thing of the game is you have to play a perfect game of Magic. So a perfect game of Magic in the sense that you cannot break any rules. The second that you get a GRV, the game is over. Or you're dead. That's how you lose. You have infinite life. You have infinite mana. You have the ability to survive all that kind of stuff. When you have a spell, you have to play that spell as soon as you possibly can.
Okay.
And then, so for instance, if it's your draw step and you draw an opportunity, you have to cast opportunity during your draw step because that's the earliest opportunity you have to cast that spell. You have to cast it immediately. The next thing on it is if you have a permanent in play that has activated abilities, you have to activate that ability as soon as you can, and you have to do it once per turn cycle. Now, if you have two things that can happen at the same time, you're perfectly fine to do it. So, for instance, if you have two creatures, then you can play those creatures in whatever order that you want to from your hand. Vice versa, if they all have activated abilities, you can choose which activated ability you start with. But for instance, the Deathclaw card that Rashok? What was the card that you spoiled? That was the 2/2
Death Dealer.
So, Death Dealer or no? I don't want to talk about Death Dealer. Well, Death Dealer has multiple activated abilities on it, right? It has
right.
+1/+0, and it has the regenerate.
Right.
Right? So, for instance, if I had that card in play, I would untap. It would be my upkeep. At the beginning of my upkeep, I activate the +1/+1. I hold priority and I activate regenerate. Because I have to use both of those abilities as soon as I possibly can. So anytime the stack is empty, if I have an instant or an activated ability, I have to use it right away. So little stupid shit like that. And then you play with a deck of cards that has just a lot of really complicated cards in it. Of how do these cards work? Our deck that we have going on in our area is being run by Huxley Bentz. He's an L2 judge in the Edmonton area. And he's been, you know, traveling, kind of getting himself up the judge program. He's only been in it for a couple of years. So he's got his deck list, his judge tower posted online as public list. I'm actually going to, I'll share it with, I guess, you, because Kyle's not around for this. But what he's also doing is he's tracking kills on the cards. So.
Oh, wow.
He's got three cards in it right now because it's done up. He's got right now 170 cards in the deck. So you just pile the cards, you shuffle them all up, you put them in a stack, you draw a card, and you play with it. And usually what you'll do is you'll take cards and you'll put them off to the side when you're done playing a game, and you keep playing until you run through the whole deck. And when you get down to a little bit, you reshuffle everything. So the three most lethal cards in the deck are Pyre Wild Shaman, Simic Manipulator, and Whip of Erebos. I can tell you which things they were killed by most recently. So, for instance, the Whip of Erebos' most recent kill was myself. And what happened with that is I had drawn a few cards because I had gotten the Dragon Lord's prerogative or whatever like that. So one of the other things with these cards is that if it has an alternated casting cost or an alternate casting cost, you have to cast it by the alternate casting cost.
What?
Yeah. So if you have like a Megamorph, you have to morph it, unmorph it, and then if it has any abilities, you have to go through that. Whereas I got there's the blue guy that's like triple blue, that Megamorph that was like mythic in one of the most recent sets. It exiles itself. So I had argued with Huxley that this card can't be in the deck because if I have it, I have to cast it as a morph, unmorph it with Megamorph. Then I have to activate all of its activated abilities. Once I get to the exile, I have to exile it, bring it back into play, and then I have to run through all the activated abilities again. So I would create a loop. So there's a little stupid stuff like that. So one of the things that I ran into was I had a Whip of Erebos. The graveyard's full of all of these like crazy creatures. I've got one of the creatures in the graveyard, though, is the 2/2 that sacrifices to destroy an enchantment. So okay. I'm sitting there and I'm like, oh, geez, okay, I got to get rid of these cards. Okay, this Whip of Erebos is going to kill me because all the stupid effects. But I've got that 2/2 in the graveyard. Great. Throw down the Whip of Erebos. Activate it. Target this thing. Bring it into play. Sacrifice it to pull up the Whip of Erebos. Yeah. And they're like, yeah, you didn't exile the creature. And I'm like, ah, shit. Because I had remembered that the Whip of Erebos trigger will still go on the stack even if the creature is no longer in play. But I missed out on the fact that I was supposed to exile the 2/2 when I had sacked it to kill the Whip of Erebos. So stupid little shit like that where it's like, didn't play it perfect. one of the ones that we run into would be Aetherlyn. So when you run through Aetherlyn, you use all of its activated abilities, you have the exile, and then it comes back into play at the end of turn or at the beginning of the end step. So it came back into play at the beginning of the end step. Person didn't activate all those triggers or activate all those abilities again at the beginning of the end step. They waited until the next player's upkeep. They missed out because they could have activated all the abilities then. So it's one of those things where it's like playing Magic in a minefield because you have to play the game perfectly and you're forced to always make an action. So if you have an instant like in your opening hand and it's an opponent's turn, you have to do it. You have to do everything in turn order as well. There's a the black creature that was in, I think, Cars or whatever, like Khans of Tarkir, where you can sacrifice other creatures. And then it also has the ability to pay mana to put it from the graveyard on top of your library. So that card hits the graveyard. Active player says, okay, I'm going to activate this ability. Well, it's my turn now. I have to activate that ability because it's illegal because we all share a graveyard. So that card is in my graveyard. I have to activate its ability. So then the next guy has to activate its ability or that guy will lose because he didn't make the play that he had to do. He's forced to make a play. So it's just wild because it puts you into like all of these really odd situations where you're trying to play the game absolutely perfect and graveyard order matters. So you have to understand that when creatures die in combat, what order do they go into the graveyard? and all that kind of stuff.
Wow.
Yeah. So the games will usually only last like 4 or 5 turns. They will be very long turns. You will be sitting there doing things, trying to like, did I just die? What do I do here? How do I play this correctly? When am I supposed to flip these cards? When am I supposed to indicate damage? What does this mean for things? It's funny because like Bloodgift Demon is a great card to have because you put it on the table and you immediately start giving your opponents more cards. Like drawing cards is the worst thing that you can do in this.
How popular is this, Jared? Is he the only one? This is like the first time I've heard about this.
I don't know. I think it's a thing that's out there. I don't think that Huxley came up with this idea. I don't know how many of them are around, but it's he's got a pretty good list here. Like he's got the current tower right now has 170 cards. He's got another 220 cards on his wish list, but it looks like some of his wish list cards are actually now in the deck, because I'm seeing some of the things on his wish list are already in the deck. He's got a suggestion page where you can sit there and put on cards that you should have in there. Rejected cards that he wanted, and then removed cards. I'm not too sure what this is for, but I imagine that the Megamorph guy would probably get put on this list. But what he's going to do is he's going to sit there and start doing some like fun sleeving and everything like that. He's going to play around with it a little bit. So when a card hits like so many kills, he's going to change the color of sleeve. So you'll be playing through it and you'll see like, oh, there's a silver card on top. Like this one's fucked up a lot of people just to make you feel bad that you're going to be drawing it soon. But
okay.
Yeah, but it's a pretty cool little format. Like, again, I'll post the list. These cards aren't like insane for like value or anything like that. It's all pretty regular stuff, a lot of like draft type of stuff. Trying to think like what is the most expensive card that I've seen on here. Wow, there's maybe Jace Architect of Thought. Like it's all really, really cheap cards. It's all the really weird ones. World Gorger Dragon, I guess that might have some value. But just stupid cards like that. Karmic Guide. Like, Karmic Guide just is a nightmare-type card. Coalition Honor Guard. That's a great card for killing people. All that kind of stuff. There's one on there where it's a flash enchantment that regenerates creatures. Like, that one there. That one gets people. There's a Blade Trap one that's like an artifact that you can play as an instant. And then you can sacrifice it to do 2 damage to all attacking and blocking creatures. Well, that card you have to cast and you have to activate it immediately because it doesn't care if there's creatures attacking or blocking at the time. You just have to do it. So it's like little pieces like that where it's like, well, you missed out on this, so you die. One of the things was Monstrous. You have to activate Monstrous every turn. If a creature is already Monstrous, when you activate Monstrous, it just doesn't do anything, but it's still a legal play to activate Monstrous when a creature is already Monstrous. So it's those little type of things where it's like, well, you screwed up there. And then one of the other like rules is X always has equal 5. So you'll get like some cards that you can't play until they're really, really bad for you. Like there's a take creatures from the graveyard and put them back in your hand. But it's whatever X is. So you play that thing when there's like 5 creatures in the graveyard, which is just terrible because now it means you have 5 cards in your hand. And it's just a game where the more cards you have in your hand, the worse life is.
Are you pretty good, would you say, in this format?
Understanding the rules is very important for it. So I can hold my own. I'm not usually the first person out. I was winning a bunch of games in it. So that's a positive part. It's a game where you don't attack other people a lot. If you have a really, really, really strong understanding of rules and how the game's supposed to be played, you can set up your opponent for really, really awkward situations. But it's definitely like one of those spots where it's like you have to understand how cards work. Like I was in a situation where like 3 creatures died in combat and I had a Mimic Vat. So I had to understand what order those creatures go to the graveyard so that I can activate Mimic Vat correctly because I have to run through it properly. And having that is really, really strong. But like one of the cards that they have in this thing is Fact or Fiction. So, like, Fact or Fiction is just, like, a terrible card to draw because, like, now you're giving your opponent the ability to create, like, card combos that make just rules nightmares, like, flip the table style situations. So, it's pretty gross. And that's how you attack other players, is that you just have to have a strong understanding of the rules so that you can recognize when they screw up. Because a lot of the times, people screw up and they don't know they screwed up. Nobody dies because they chose to do something incorrectly. People die because they forgot, they missed, they didn't understand how the rules work. They miss for those reasons. So that's where it's really strong, is that the way that you win the game is just having better knowledge than your opponents and playing extremely tight, which I have a little bit of one and I don't usually have much of the other. So, like, it's good for practice in that sense.
Yeah, it just sounds like maybe a decent way of improving just your rules.
Yeah. Like, honestly, KYT, I don't know what it would cost to put this thing together. You might have it just in, like, draft commons and stuff like that. But to build one of these things, take it into the shop, sit down with the guys, and just run through a few games of it. Make sure you've got whoever's got the judgy brains at your store, like at the face-to-face guys, je face à face, to kind of sit there and run through it. And just, it's wild how swingy everything is and how difficult things are, just how you have to look at cards a little bit differently. But you also learn things. You learn a great deal of things because you have to understand all these corner case rules and all these things that don't usually matter. All these things that Magic Online takes care of for you.
I love the I'm searching it on Google, and like the Reddit thread is, the title is Judge Tower, a Magic format for judges and people who hate themselves.
Yes, it is. It is a very, very difficult way to play Magic. So, okay, it's good. There's a Reddit thing. So people out there know about it already.
First comments like, I want to play this, 91 points, Reddit points. To show you how brutal this format is, I'll tell you turn by turn how I lost my first three games of Judge Tower. Game 1, turn 1. Okay, untap, upkeep, draw. Main phase 1, cast Brainstorm. You lose. Brainstorm is an instant, so you have to retain priority in the draw step and cast it then.
Yeah. How I lost game 1 of Judge Tower was, we played a 3-player game. I went first. I didn't draw for my turn. Died due to environment. Dead. So at least they didn't have to put a mark on the card. Because he actually puts a mark, a kill count, on the sleeves.
So, on the sleeve?
Yeah, wow. So he just has a Sharpie there and he marks it down. And then he keeps a written log that he puts onto this list. So you can tell that a card has, like, killed this many people and stuff like that. It's really cool, like, the way he's doing it.
Sweet, sweet. If anybody has ever played this and has cool stories, we'd appreciate it in the comments. Other than that, Jerry, is there any events that you plan on playing in the next week or so, or in the next month?
So, yeah, I've got actually some really busy Magic weeks. Like, the nice thing is work is finally calming down. We hit our big deadline that we had to, or our big, what would you call that? They have a word for it, and I don't have vocabulary anymore because I work in the trades. So we usually just communicate with grunts, but a benchmark or whatever we hit. And now work is going to be really calm pretty much for the rest of this job. So we're going to go back to the 5-2 schedule. We're going to start doing 10-hour days instead of 12-hour days. So I'm going to get a little bit more free time. So this weekend, we got a 3-day weekend because it's a long weekend. The two big events that are happening are Saturday. We have the Red Deer face-to-face tournament series 2K. So that's modern there. About 75% to play that. That's the tournament I think I really want to play because it's modern and I have fun with modern and it just seems like it's going to be a good time and it's in Red Deer, so I can go to Red Deer. And, you know, that would just be fun. The other tournament is on Sunday. It is an EMA-sealed PPTQ.
Fuck ballers.
Yeah, it's going to be like $80. I don't think I'm going to have any fun, but I'm also not queued for the RPTQ, and the RPTQ is in Edmonton. Like, one of the spots is in Edmonton this year, or this season. So I really want to get into that tournament. but I really don't want to play the CMA sealed tournament. It just seems like it's going to be stupid. It's like going to be $80, and I just don't know if this set is really going to translate well to a sealed environment. I don't know anything about it. And I don't want to play in two tournaments because I like to hang out with my family. So thinking I'll probably just go and do the Fast-a-Fast 2K, have some fun with that, play some Madden, dredge it up because dredge is where it's at, and get ready for the next weekend because the next weekend is the WMCQ.
Yeah.
And the face-to-face tournament series, Edmonton 5K. 5K.
5K.
5K. Montreal gets 3K. Toronto gets 3K. Edmonton gets 5K.
Yeah, and if you're one of those people who got screwed by us in the last Edmonton tournament, you should be contacting, if you haven't already, customer service at facetofacegames.com because we are compensating those people with a free entry and I think even a free side event draft or something.
Wow, you guys are like super like...
We're trying to make it up to all those people. So we've, you know, again, we strive to try to better ourselves every time. And like the GP and everything. So hope you guys come out. Like 5K is pretty crazy.
5K in Edmonton. Is pretty in Edmonton. Don't be like that. Right now, they're projecting our... I was just talking to the TO for the WMCQ. That's Mike Lewis at Warp 2. And he was telling me that for the WMCQ, they actually had a problem because they were only going to give out, they only gave 150 foils for the, like the abrupt decays or whatever, for the sign, like the register or whatever, the participation promo. And the numbers that he's projecting from his pre, his, what do you call that? Jeez.
This is projections.
Yeah, well, projections based off of his pre-reg already.
Right.
Putting him somewhere closer to two, like high 180, one, like somewhere around there. So he had to get in touch with Watsy and tell them, like, look, we've already been tracking this. We already know we're going to bust through the 150. They're getting really afraid every time people are advertising that there is the abrupt decay. He was always having to make little sub-notes saying, like, for the first 150 people who register and... He really hated that kind of stuff. And it looks like Wizards of the Coast is now giving them more foils to make sure that they have enough foils for everything. So, but
is that a maybe or is that a confirm?
It's confirmed from Wizards of the Coast that he's going to have more than 150 foils.
Okay.
So there's not going to be any bad news stories of people getting turned away without the foils or whatever, or getting entry without the foils, because that's just crappy.
He had voiced his concerns to me this afternoon. He was asking for my pre-regis numbers and what my actual attendance numbers to give him a better gauge for his projections.
Yeah.
And yeah, like if he was going to get screwed, people listening and planning to play, fucking pre-register to get that abrupt decay. But if it sounds like he's getting more, still probably pre-register. I don't know how much more he's getting and how many people will actually show up. So
yeah,
if you do plan on playing it, just sign up right away.
Yeah,
dudes,
absolutely, because
dudettes.
It'll be a big tournament, and who knows going to travel for it. Like, he did some smart things. He went through, and he went through his registered players list and compared it to the invite list. So he's got that information of, like, everybody who plays in the city that's been at one of his events. Like, he's the biggest store in the city, so his events see everybody. So he's got a great database of players, so he was able to say, okay, that's 100. I think he had 150 or something crazy players. I can't remember. Now I'm pulling numbers out of my ass, but I know it was over 100 players that were on both lists. So had played at the store and were invited. So he was able to, okay, I've got that. Then that doesn't count for any of the travelers and all that kind of stuff. So he's expecting a pretty big tournament. And then to have the face-to-face 5K there the next day is just huge. Because that's going to help draw people out as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm excited for it. I mean, we had... I think we had 168 for WMCQ, and then we had 100 for the Open. And, again, whenever you get over 100 for some of these non, let's say, like in the old days, like for these non Pro Tour related tournaments, that's usually a pretty big deal. You know, it's funny, like compared to some of the US numbers, like we actually are genuinely excited when we get a reasonable amount of people in like Newfoundland or in Moncton or in Quebec City, like a lot of these like places that we don't go often or just are not known to have an insane amount.
Yeah, like what was Saskatoon's numbers?
I haven't gotten them yet, so
okay.
Vicente is coming back hopefully in the office. I think he's coming back tomorrow morning, so I'm going to get all the data and all the deck lists tomorrow morning, and hopefully it's yeah. But like a number to some people who might. Like that might not be impressive to other people. It's just like relatively speaking to us, it can be like over, I think something over like some cities, like over 50 is just amazing. Just because you know that place, you know, sort of has like a dozen or 20 players in some of their tournaments. So getting like from 50 to 70, depending on the place, you know, can be something, could be a great, not that we're super amazed by it, but it's a great starting point. And we've seen, like, especially Quebec City and Newfoundland, that I remember distinctively, like, the numbers have been going up from the MDSS years, going up and up. And FDF Open pushed another level as the game gets more popular and as we try to push the series even more. So it's a good trend. And we're just trying to hopefully find success in these many different pockets in Canada, not ignore any part, but of course sometimes cost prevents us if it's not a city that's known to have any players at all, so we can't necessarily jump into that. But definitely happy, like I know Matt is the happiest at some of the cities that you wouldn't expect him, like Match Malls, to be happy about. When I initially started working, like he's super enthusiastic about Newfoundland and stuff like that, and to me it's like, why? There's not as many people as in Montreal and Toronto, but he's like, you don't understand, like those people are insanely happy to see us because they don't have that many premier level tournaments. So
yeah, like the big tournament that they would get is if they managed to get an old style PTQ. That would be right. The big tournament in the area.
Yeah, and they love it when a big store comes in and has some amount of stock to sell and are willing to buy cards, some of their collection at a decent price as well. So that's always awesome to hear. Like, I was always surprised.
Hey, when can I do my pre-order, my pickup at event order? Like, when do you do the cutoffs for those? Is that going to be the next day or two?
It's going to be the next day or two, but not if you plan on picking stuff up for Edmonton. You got next week. But want it for Red Deer, I would recommend
Red Deer
tomorrow.
Yeah, because if I want to get stuff for the WMCQ, I need to get it at Red Deer.
Yeah, so what happens is when the orders come in, they get processed. Like, we process them super early in the morning.
Yeah.
And then, you know, one of us, not me, but Vicente or Matt Schmaltzy will fly out. So it's got to be reasonably, like, if they fly out Wednesday or Thursday, so that really dictates the deadline for some of these, and that's why it has to be as early as it sounds. Like, that's why Tuesday is pretty super safe.
Yeah.
Usually, as long as they're not flying out randomly super early. So, you know, I would just get them as soon as possible, Jer.
Sweet.
As for me, I'm not sure there's much for me. Like, I'm just excited about the pre-release that I will definitely play. I'm excited about GP Montreal. I've yet to reg for that, but I'm more than likely playing that. So that's what I'm looking forward to like some new cards.
Do you like the spoilers? Do you like the mechanics?
So far, like but every set we have people, I don't know, like Jay calling the mechanics like lazy and boring, and I've never had that type of feeling. I mean, I'm just going to still play. I haven't seen, there hasn't been really, there's mechanics in the past that I wish they explored more, but I don't, that they just had like in a random and common cycle, rather, whatever, or just unplayable cards. And I wish that they were on more relevant cards. But for the most part, there's never been a mechanic that I really hated. What about you?
Meld is strange. Like, I understand it. I don't know how I feel about it. I love the fact that it made sense of the Hanweir battle, or the whatever the Hanweir battlements flips into, like that thing. The Hanweir, the wreathing or writhing township, like that card that had been kind of spoiled, and trying to figure out, like, how does this card make sense? How do you have a town that turns into a creature or whatever like that, that flips into a creature? What does that look like? So I was really happy to see kind of how the melds kind of work that in flavor wise. That's okay. I think Emerge is really cool. I really like that as an ability.
You may cast this spell by sacrificing a creature and paying the Emerge cost reduced by that creature's converted mana cost.
Yeah, so you cast like a 3-drop, and then a couple turns later you Emerge into something bigger by sacrificing that.
Okay, so it's like you're paying tribute and you're getting a reduction of costs. Okay.
Yeah, so
I like it.
Yeah, that's kind of cool. I like the Escalate. I thought that was a neat little mechanic.
Whereas, pay this cost for each mode chosen beyond the first. Okay.
Yeah, so it'd be like a modal spell, and you can choose more than one mode if you're willing to pay the DLC price. And yeah, like that's just kind of cool stuff.
Wow. If they're like strong constructed cards, that makes games really interesting. Like, oh man, he can pay for those two or three things to happen, and you know, how am I going to play around that? So that might be interesting.
Yeah. I liked Gisela, who's just ridiculous. They made her not strong in Modern, which was nice. Because, you know, she's going to eat bolts left, right, and center. But flying, right, First Strike Lifelink for 4 mana? Sure.
Yeah, just double white at the end of your end step. If you both own and control Gisela the Broken Blade and a creature named Bruna the Fading Light, exile them, then meld them into Brizella, Voice of Nightmares.
Yeah. And then that card's just ridiculous. Flying, First Strike, Vigilance, Lifelink. Opponent can't cast spells with converted mana cost 3 or less. Things that won't happen. But I like our new Wild Nacatl in the Knotwood Dryad, Narwhal Dryad with the Delirium. That's kind of neat. Upsubstantiate seems really cool. I don't know if you saw that one. The return target spell or creature to its owner's hand for a blue and a colorless.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, so there's some neat stuff in this set. See what else comes from it.
Man, the meld thing's definitely... I'm sure people have made the comparison, but...
Oh, everyone's going on about it's a Yu-Gi-Oh thing.
Yeah.
I don't know, but...
Polymerization!
I don't know what that means.
But I kind of like it in a way. It's kind of cool.
Anything else you've been doing? Like, what else are you doing? You doing non-magic stuff these days? You playing video games? You watching TVs? Like...
No.
You're such a loser. Not much,
man. I am such a non... I don't know what the word... Non...
I'm not a loser. You're a loser.
Nope. Not doing much. Just a lot of... I tried my hand at Hearthstone a bit.
Okay.
Got back into chess. Got really into performing... Magic, that's a big thing.
Oh, yeah.
I had sort of resurrected out of nowhere that day where I posted an old YouTube clip of 10 years ago.
I don't know how you got money in the can.
it's a very good trick that I learned from like 10 years ago, of course, when I first saw it, it blew me away. And now when there was talk, when I showed some people at work and had mentioned that I used to perform Magic, and I actually had a deck
in my drawer. So at work, so I took it out at one point, and yeah, it just started. And Steven Retta, Sal's son, has basically made it a challenge. Well, not really a challenge, that he wants to see a new trick every week.
Oh yeah.
And I honestly don't remember a lot of stuff, so it's just forced me to go back. So like, some people don't have no idea how people learn magic. I think they just think that they, I don't know what the
just people's YouTube concept it, right?
Yeah, or just YouTube it, or just figure, or these magicians just like develop some technique by themselves. But no, there's just like an insane amount of books and even DVDs on the art, and it's a matter of just rereading some of the concepts and DVDs, and coming up with something and performing for him. So that's been fun. And he's one of those guys that there's good audiences, and there's, you know, the bad, well, not really, they're not bad. It's just,
they're not there for the fun. They're there to figure out how you did it.
Right. And even then, I mean, there's a certain level. I think the worst is when they're trying to figure out and they start like doing stuff that they start breaking the presentation that you're trying to show.
Okay.
Like randomly taking the cards and feeling them, right? When, you know, maybe it doesn't even ruin the trick, but it certainly ruins the flow if you have this certain story that you want to tell. And some tricks are basically, I mean, a lot of tricks are just based on some sort of presentation for, because there has to be a motivation for why you're doing certain things, why you're putting this card here, why are you having this card sign. And yeah, some, for the most part, people are really nice. And then there's Petey Pablo, who has random, I guess, family dinners with either his girlfriend's family or his own, and he's asked me to show him like one or two simple tricks, and I had to look up some that were like super easy to do that didn't require any sleight of hand, that are still powerful without being super like lame and mathematical.
Yeah.
And he was able to impress. So I've been pretty happy. It's pretty cool.
So you've taken on apprentices.
Yeah, I guess in a way, even though I'm not a master, but I've had resources in the past, and yeah, the art is just fascinating. I do wonder sometimes whether, I mean, it's a debate amongst the magician community, whether the fact that people know that you can learn it from books or DVDs, if it just like takes out some of the mystique, right, from the magician. Because it's like, for someone that's wants to be amazed by it, they want to feel like the guy actually has something, depending on the trick, definitely has some sort of special ability. Right, let's say it's being able to memorize an entire deck in order that people can actually do without magic, but those guys are like crazy memory people with memory tricks. But does it take away from the mystique if you know that the secret is behind a book? Maybe, but it's definitely a question.
I think it's all in the execution, all in the story you're able to present.
Yeah, and now my thinking is, nowadays it doesn't even matter, because there's like so many YouTube videos now that, you know, like there's a bunch of how-to stuff. And so, you know, and I think that I'm impressed by a magician who, even if I know is sleight of hand, but is executed so well, you can't help by being impressed, not by the trick itself, but the sheer amount of skill that he has and confidence. So yeah, even I'm amazed by certain presentations.
Yeah, I had the fortune to, when I was in Vegas, to go and see Penn and Teller. And I don't know if you've seen their show.
Yeah, I have.
Yeah, so their stand-up routine there, where they essentially, they're like, here's how these people abuse you. Here's an example of you getting abused. There's nothing here, just, it's all about skill. There's nothing, you know, otherworldly about it. And then they'd go and do, you know, some sleight of hand tricks, and they show you kind of the one side where you're supposed to be looking and how things just disappear and reappear and all this kind of crazy stuff happens. And then they'll actually like turn him the other direction and show you the kind of behind the scenes version, where you can see where things are moving and switching hands and this is getting traded off for a different one, and the one that was lit is now behind his ear, but you didn't notice that because he went and brushed his hat and all right. this kind of stuff, you know, and it just shows you, like, there's nothing magical about this. It's just they are taking advantage of the ability that you're just going to follow things that are moving, and you're going to look here when you're supposed to be looking there, and he's going to do this to make sure you're looking here when you're supposed to be looking there. And I really got a kick out of that, and that's what I enjoy when I watch these tricks. I know that there's nothing magical about it, but I just love the execution. I love seeing, okay, they just pulled this off. How did they pull this off? And how did they make it look so smooth? And what was the point where I was supposed to notice something went wrong? Like, where did my ability to follow things fail me? So.
Right. It's like it's a double whammy. They amaze you initially.
Yeah.
And then they show you how it's done, and you're still amazed by the different steps and the physical steps that the teller has to do usually. It's just like, you're just impressed, even if they're just showing you the secret, which can be the case for a lot of tricks. But sometimes, like, the simple card stuff, people are like, oh, okay. Like, oh, that's it. Even though it's, like, sometimes a really subtle... I mean, even the most obvious thing, the fact that you initially got fooled by it meant, like, there was some... a level of execution that needed to be done.
Oh yeah, so. Absolutely.
But other than that, I had last week I debuted a new, I think, monthly project of mine. I always wanted to do a
podcast that wasn't the A-Team.
A podcast that wasn't the A-Team. A Google Hangouts show that.
That's still always, a thing. Is Google Hangouts still a thing?
I mean, I'm trying to make it a thing, so maybe it won't be.
Do people use Google Hangouts?
Really wanted to go back to, I say, the roots of why I started Man Deprived, which is highlight some of the important Canadian personalities of our community, just to get people to, I guess, notice each other more, to work together more, and. Some of these guys, even Alex Hain, I felt like a lot of players, most players in the world, even myself, only had a surface knowledge of what the guy's about in terms of where he started and what he's and other thoughts.
Yeah, they might not understand how much of a troll he is. You know, they might they might see the Alex Hain that we all see on the coverage page and not understand how. He's walking around with a backgammon case in his back pocket so that he can gamble with you.
Or Oreo cookies that can flip. That has heads or tails. So it was an interesting talk with him that I had. It was I planned these shows to be an hour, but with me and him, we went close to an hour and a half, maybe even 2 hours. I don't really remember. But yeah, hopefully getting guys like him, Pascal Maynard.
Pascal? You know,
Sean McLaren, hopefully I can get him on, and just focus on getting to know these guys a bit better and maybe gain a few nuggets of knowledge when it comes to how they were able to attain the levels of success that they have, something that I'm always curious about how what makes them different from the regular grinders who have a very small percentage chance of ever even winning a PTQ. So what steps do they take to not be one of those guys? So check that out for sure.
Check it out.
And I'm hoping to get people from the West, of course, because of course I'm friends and I know people from the East, but guys like Sean McLaren and even more people from the West would be awesome. And judges. That's what I really want to know because no one really gives a fuck about them. So
yeah,
I want to put them. I do. So whether it's Chris Lanzel, Jason Wong, Jonathan Good, I love that guy from the East. And then you know, get some of the people from the West as well that I know far less about.
Yeah.
So that's it for this show. hopefully Jay and next week you'll have Jay and Matt Mendoza.
Oh, did we not have them here today? I didn't notice.
I thought, you know, obviously I agree with you, Jarvis wasn't a comical type of a guest, but still appreciated the knowledge.
Yeah, so, no, absolutely. He was great to have on.
Hopefully the
he did not bring the energy, but I don't know if he has the energy.
Hopefully the usual A-Team fans were able to make it to this party if they were expecting a little more energy from of course Jeremy.
Dick and balls. There you go. You guys get your big payoff.
So for me and Jeremy Schofield, this is goodbye. We'll see you next week.
I love you all.